What has your mind been flooded by
Well,
over there in Italy?
one thing, I'm a complete mountain man right now because I haven't shaved or my fingernails. I've never had them this long in my life.
You got no woman to keep you in check.
Yeah. And I'm kind of liking it. I want to see how long they grow.
Like a dead man, like one of these found Egyptian mummies, right? Where they're all kind of
Yeah.
folded down, right?
I'm kind of liking the isolation of it. It's shocking, but the days fly by for me, even though I'm a prisoner in my hotel room with the window closed and everything, like the curtains closed. But the days fly by because I'll lay in my bed looking up at the ceiling for 2 hours and just think. And the thought comes to me, and I reach over and write it in a notebook, and then I think some more and I write it. And so I guess what I realize is in the last number of years, I haven't had that. So my contemplation time is just incredible to me, and I have to maintain this going forward, this momentum going forward, and go back to Romania for sure.
Are you going out of the house or out of the room?
Only when they want to clean, and I only let her clean my room every 3 days. So, I go for breakfast in the morning. There's a breakfast down below me, which is a nice little breakfast. And I go down at 7 o'clock in the morning. I have a breakfast, have coffee, do a little bit of people watching for 45 minutes, and come back to my room for the day. And so I don't have to leave this hotel. I have everything self-contained here. And she cleans my room every 3 days or so. And then when she does, I'll go for a walk. So, but other than that, I don't really leave.
So it's like you've bought yourself 6 days a week of sitting in your room where nothing can possibly distract you, not the internet, not
Yeah.
Deanna, not anyone, not any of the
Nothing.
thousands of people that come through the city like Bucharest on a weekly basis.
No, I don't even contact Deanna. I talked to her for a long time this morning. That's the first time in almost, well, basically a week. It's incredible. Good for her and good for me and good for the,
For
it's
the
good for the, I don't know. It just makes me realize, we talked last week about the shifting of Ars Amarata, where it
Yeah.
has to go. It's becoming clearer and clearer in my mind. And it's going to completely shift in a really strong, good way. And I don't know, man. I don't know.
So what are some of the ideas that have come through the last 7 days since we spoke?
Well, it's more of a deepening of what we talked about, I think. The idea that we recognize, we have to recognize the place in history that we are, because we're in a shifting of eras, just like in about 1890, there was a shifting of eras when science came along and said, wait, Newton's physics is out the window, and relativity and atoms and uncertainty and all this certain thing that we thought the world was certain and the universe is certain is not certain. At the same time, they deconstructed art with cubism and that kind of thing. Everything all happened at once. Music was deconstructed, science, the world war. There was a major upheaval at the turn of the 1900s. And it feels like we're on the edge of some other upheaval again, where, because I mean, everything's been explored. You look at painting, for instance, right? It was representation. First it was religious art, then representation. They get more accurate, more accurate, more accurate, and Vermeer, and then photography came along. And so the painters immediately switched to, okay, let's not be representation. Let's go and find out what is the essence of Jordan instead of painting his face and his shirt. What is before me? And that's impressionism and cubism and, and right down to the point where you go into modern museums and there's just a blue canvas.
Yeah,
It
red square.
deconstructed right down to the essence of nothing but it's just a, So what's next? Do you go back to representation? It's been explored, Right now there's painting, a photorealism painting. You've seen that on the internet where somebody will take a girl in water swishing her hair and it looks like a photograph, but it's really a painting. That's how accurate the materials have become. So they couldn't do that 200 years ago because painting and pigments and stuff and brushes couldn't do it. Right. Now, technologically, they can do it, right? And artistically and, you know, understanding depth and all the kinds of stuff, they can do it. So you have that photorealism on one side to break down to nothing, a simple black line on a canvas, and that's, or you know, in sculpture too. So what else is there? What can the next era of painting be?
Yeah, culture war. You've got every end of every polarity all fighting each other out there in the scene.
Death. So somebody brand new comes along and says, I want to be a painter. What do they paint? A mountain? What do they paint? Everything is, you know, has been captured before, photorealism down to a simple line to the impression of something. So what is it, a new Jordan that, you know, turns to 19, goes to art school and he wants to become a painter? What's he going to paint? That hasn't been done. What is, you know, when, and same with, you know, things like music.
Yeah. So you map the same trend in every art, music, literature, poetry.
To the nth degree. And so now where, but it is going to change, but to what? That if we can put our finger on that, because art, music, literature followed the same thing. 1910, 1920, where people used to write stories and swashbuckling stories of swinging through sails. And once upon a time, there's a guy named Jordan and he went and saved the girl. And you know, all that kind of literature shifted into, I'm thinking this right now and I'm just kind of stuck in my head and stream of consciousness. And all the way up to Finnegan's Wake with James Joyce, with just nonsense rhymes. It just took language and put language out front. Didn't have any real meaning, but you go, huh? But it's the flow and structure. So what do you do with literature? Go back to stories? Where does it go? It's interesting. It has to go somewhere.
Right, right. But we're facing some kind of cultural apocalypse where everything's been done. And I think there's also a nihilism or a tiredness within the whole thing.
Yep. Absurdism, yeah. So you think it, I've been thinking a lot about this, like all of eras end and start by somebody like Einstein sitting there. Einstein erased all he knew about mathematics and physics, which wasn't much when he was young. And he just sat and looked out the window during his day job and just thought, what if a beam of light came here and hit me in the eye? What would it? And he was just daydreaming. And so he invented a brand new physics conceptually in his head just by thinking about it, you know? And all of these eras that shifted into something new is because somebody said they tried to go like a child to find, what is a color? What is the shape of a woman? What is that? Like, that's until it's down to a single line, right? That's the essence of it. So what hasn't been contemplated and shifted into is this transcendent thing we're talking about.
Yeah.
Right now there's always been a religion has dominated the world forever. There's no such thing as atheism, like 200 years ago, this didn't exist. And then the Enlightenment came along, rationalism stuff, and they said, wait a minute, so now I can be an atheist and now I don't have to believe in God. So they went to that nth degree of that. But there's something has to happen there because there's nothing in between. You're either a spiritual / religious person, which is wrong according to atheists, or you're a staunch atheist, which is wrong according to the religious people. There's nothing in between, you know? So why, you know, and so what revolution has to happen in the mind so that we can say, yes, there is, for instance, a soul and science is primary, as opposed to you guys are wrong, you know? So I don't know what it is.
But so something. Integrating.
Well, no, because here's me laying in bed. I'm thinking, if you think of any ideas out there, this is my innovation. There's
have you got your fingers on answers for what's next, or are you laying in questions?
No, I don't.
It's just an endless
don't.
Unfolding of questions.
But here's the question: how you ask it in my mind, because it's the dual nature of everything. So good and evil, religion or creation, Big Bang, you know, God, the devil, everything's got a dual nature if you really think about it. Even in, like I just talked about painting, it's representation or expression. You either represent Jordan by painting him, or you express what he, what it feels like to be Jordan or whatever, right? So everything's got this dual nature. And you think the answer is to, like, science, religion, a dual nature is one or the other. So you think that the answer is to compromise and take the best features of both, right? Mm. And but I'm thinking, no, that isn't the way. In all of these dual questions, like free will or determinism, right? Like, when you say you're going to move to Bali, is that determined by fate? Because, you know, Big Bang came along and molecules went like this, and the molecule that made your chemical brain right now is, it's not possible for you to decide anything but Bali, or God preordained it, right? So that's determinism, or free will is I get to choose and it doesn't matter what happened in the past, right? So there's a dual nature there too. But instead of trying to combine these two to come up with a compromise or a blended thing, the answer is to come up with a third way that isn't a blend. And I don't know what that looks like. So these dual nature things, what's the third way of looking at? What's the third, for instance, and I'm not sure how to, for instance, let's say you take something like the beginning of the universe. It's either a prime mover, like God or whatever, created it. It had to start, right? Or the second thing is the Big Bang started it. So but it still had to start. So if you think it's one, got to be this one or the other. It either has to have a prime mover or not, but it started, right? That's the two options only there is. Something started it or something didn't start it, but it still started. So what's the third thing? The compromise would be, well, a prime mover, but he just left it to go. But what if there's a third way? And I don't know what it is, you know? Like, what if there's a, I don't know. I don't know.
So is this the cutting edge of your where your mind is when you're laying on the bed?
Yeah, it's one thing I was thinking about recently. Because, you know, I wrote in my book that all, like, we have this concept that I can't have that girl that I saw walking on the street, even though I covet her and I would really like to be with a girl like that. She's totally my type of girl. I can't have her because I got this wife and kids. Right. And so I wrote this whole essay about this, where a man goes, well, it's easy for you to say to choose what you want. I can't, because I would choose her, but I can't because they got this. And then my answer to that is if you're saying you want this girl, but you can't because you can't have the kids, you basically have an obligation, which is an anchor, okay? Mm. So when you go back to the wife and kids, you look at them with bad eyes. You're thinking, you know, I'm stuck with you. So your heart's not there. Your heart's with the woman walking down the street that you saw. But if, on the other hand, if you choose the woman and leave the wife and kids for the woman, then the wife and kids are sad and you lost something. You feel sad because you lost something. So you think, oh, I'm stuck between two bad choices, you know? And instead you think you're between two good choices. And the two good choices, I think everything, every decision, everything fork in your life or everything can be come down to two things. There's two things that you want, not two things you're stuck with or have to do. You don't have to say, I have to do this because I got married to this woman, right?
Yeah.
You say, I choose what a good choice in life is for me to have my wife and children and to consciously choose them. And to move forward with them in good grace, right? I chose it. Hmm. And a second beautiful option, which take morality, religion out of it, whatever, is me and that woman together would be a fantastic, beautiful thing. Those are two positives now. You take all those things and make positives out of them on one hand or the other. That's a positive, right? And all you have to decide then is by looking at the two positives, which one you would rather choose in a positive way, as opposed to I'm stuck with it, right? And then you're consciously choosing. So it doesn't matter if you choose the woman, because you consciously chose her. You consciously chose that, you know, and it doesn't matter if you choose the wife and kids.
Yeah.
So, so everything, so that's a dual nature. So the third thing that I'm talking about, you're not doing a compromise. The third thing is you're shifting the way you look at it into two positives and then choosing one that would make your heart feel better in life. Recognizing I'm going to be sad because of this, but I still choose this. Something like that.
Right.
The third way.
And that third way is a much more intelligent conversation. Because rather than nagging at the compromise between the two of them, then you get to answer, like, what is it about that single woman walking down the street, which is so, gives me so much? And what facet of that can I take home and put in my existing relationship? Like, what was it? You know, what is missing at home so that I look for that and pine for that? And what creativity can I use? Like something about her walk or her dress, or how can I find a way to see my wife like that? You start asking questions like that.
Now you're having a mindful way of going through life. You mindfully said, you know what? I would really like to be with that woman, but I don't want to lose the security and fun with my wife and kids. And I want to continue to nurture that. That's a conscious choice for your wife and kids. Now, when you walk in the door, you're not, I'm stuck with these people and angry and frustrated and taking it out on them. You walk in with a notion that I've consciously chosen you. Yeah, I had something great out there, but I chose you. And they can feel that energy, right? So, or vice versa, the other way around. And so it becomes a net positive in some way. But it's a third way of looking at it, as opposed to, I can't have that because I got to do this. It's like saying, I can't live in Thailand because of the things. So I got to go to Bali, or you know what I mean, right? It's like there's two beautiful choices, and do I want to try and maintain this, or I want to do that?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I haven't explored this fully, but I think a lot.
I think all these paradoxes come together in the next stage, whatever that will be.
Yeah.
With the commitment thing, freedom and commitment, they seem like two opposite sides of the coin, but there's actually tremendous, there's tremendous freedom in commitment. Because as soon as you realize, wow, I've chosen fully to commit to my girl, then the temptation to look at another girl is just a temptation. It's not going to get acted upon. And within that, you stop chasing around dozens and dozens of women looking for the right one, or looking for kicks, or looking for validation, or whatever it might be. And then you've got one, and it's like, wow, look how much energy I've now saved that I can put into some other pursuit.
Exactly.
It's
freedom. Something culturally is going to change. And, you know, it may be that Western society, you know, that started with Rome and Greece has run its course. I don't know. And maybe
that's 100
years
from
now, it's going to be the Eastern philosophies that are going to, you know, like China and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they could dominate as civilization. So then what do you go forth with? For instance, what kind of work could we create that you translate the Chinese, and the Chinese go, this is glorious?
Well, it's an interesting time. You know, we're recording this, we're about to make this promo series for the masculinity for the 2020s, talking about where our Zamorata stands in all of this, and men today, like, where do we stand? And I've taken this moment in time to just the last couple of months to really step back and read a bit more broadly about what's really going on. Because I grew up in the 80s, 90s, 2000s. That's when my kind of mindset was formed by what is current in the world. And it's liberal democracy, late capitalism, right?
Yeah.
I can follow my dreams, go anywhere I want. Everyone's got equal vote, equal rights. And it's basically a party. You know, go and do what you want. And as long as you're making enough money, like, no one gives a shit. Just try and not harm anyone else. And it feels like if we're on the cutting edge of the next phase and we don't know what's going to come next in all these different pursuits, some things that are on the horizon are, there's a chance that our political system, liberal democracy, is on the wane. A lot of our countries are actually bankrupt. Yeah. A lot of other countries are actually rising. A lot of countries from the States to the UK, different factions in parts of Europe, Russia, China, particularly, are very much more nationalistic than before. Yes. People are, I think, seeing through some of the liberalism, especially some of the culture wars that we've got at the moment, like this facet of this tribe of people at war with this tribe of people within the United States, within the same town, ideologically, it's come out of this very liberal model. And now that's, you know, what happened to our mysticism and what happened to the grandeur of our country and what happened to being British, you know, that was all getting, slung out, you know, going bit by bit into Europe, which is a very progressive thing. But at the same time, people are wondering about their identity and how things are changing so fast.
And it's who are we right now? Python from internal. And I tell you, it is really in danger. That idea of like, what does it mean to be British? You know?
Yeah.
That is on its, I don't know how to save it. I don't know if you can save it.
There's a book, The Strange Death of Europe. Don't need to say too much about it, but you can imagine the way that the very old identities and ways of being and culture that's been very loved is just being given up by generations of people that aren't actually very willing to fight for anything that came before. It's like, why would I fight for that old
stuff? That's the whole idea of conservatism, is to conserve institutions, conserve literature, conserve music that was handed down, that had meaning, you know, that created the, for instance, the British soul or the Canadian identity, and hand that down. That's the idea of culture. And the liberal mind is to deconstruct culture and say, you know, no. And that's what globalism too, is like to erase borders, erase languages, and erase this, you know? So, but for better or worse, that's what we're hitched to, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Unless some radical carving off of some continent comes along and some new America comes along and some conservative right-wing energy is going to say, okay, listen, we're going to take over Vietnam and make it the haven. And, you know, it's our own, political, I don't know, because it's all kind of melting internally.
Yeah. So I think perhaps this next generation of music, art, literature is going to be, maybe, perhaps, it has to be deeply embodied, because the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years has all been totally cerebral. How can I play a trick on the conceptual world of art by putting really clever ideas together and then shoving it in a gallery?
Advertising,
So it's art without soul, art without body. And I think 2020s is going to be a big decade for embodiment. People are like, look how pathetic my span of attention has become with the conditioning of screens, right? The art of philosophy, very few people can actually do that. Think coherently, argue coherently, follow some debate through to a logical conclusion, because the muscles of the mind are down to 10, 15 seconds in a lot of people as well. So I think there's going to be a movement to embodiment, a movement towards spirit. We've got these things like, I don't know what apps and bionic chips and virtual reality is going to do, but it's like, what if some rich, very progressive segment of society starts putting a chip inside them that can put their brains into a deep state of meditation and just download all information. So it's like, on the one hand, you've got the ones going for the soul, and you've got other people that are going for, how can I make myself this bionic man? What does that mean for art?
Yeah, exactly. And artificial intelligence and, you know, this kind of stuff. And it's really what is like cooking and the things that we would like have checks and balances on and really consider in the West, they don't have in the East. So would they make I shouldn't say that, you know, flippantly, but would China have the same reservation on putting chips inside citizens, for instance, than we do? I don't know. There's a different culture there, and there's a different, and maybe they're right. And we're the ones that are backwards. If that's the case, you know, you just don't know.
Yeah.
So who knows? So it's not like we can say, let's have some research and study, for instance, genetically modifying babies, right? Let's consider this and let's do it wisely. And what's the ethics of it when another country's just doing it? You know, all of a sudden they're ahead of it.
Science
is ahead of ours because they're just doing it.
Yeah.
They're not studying it or thinking of the implications. that is doing it. So you get left behind. Your culture gets left behind because you're trying to do the right thing.
Yeah. And then we don't really know about the climate and what's going on. And even our sources of information are highly dubious.
Yep.
What can we actually believe about anything that's going on in the planet?
So what happens then with what we're trying to create? Because I really do believe you are right that there's going to be a shifting and returning or a changing, going back to the idea of spirit, because I have this idea, you know, like the idea of frisson, you know, like, which is goosebumps. When you see a painting that catches your heart, or you listen to a piece of music and you get shivers, you know, or you look at, you know, the face of a loved one, she's smiling at you and you have that butterfly feeling here. That's something that science has not explained. They cannot describe that. That to me is connection, direct connection to that otherworldly transcendent sense of divine, right? Which scientists say, that's not true. It's just a bunch of chemicals flashing. I think that is the future. That's the future of Ars Amarada, is like, how do we maximize that, those experiences for ourselves and for others that come into contact with us? So in other words, if I said, I'm going to write a piece of music that's going to give Jordan goosebumps. You don't know that, right? You don't know what Jordan gets goosebumps on, right? So if I set out to, I'm going to write a piece of music that's going to give shivers down the spine of people, right? What would that look like? Death metal, you know, symphony, you don't know. So all you can do as an artist or creator is sit there and think, what would give me goosebumps?
Yeah.
And write something that you would like to hear. Write a piece of a sentence in the literature that would make you cry.
Yeah.
Because you can't assume what's going to make it for others. So, and that's what we're missing in modern art. We're missing, like right now, it's just shock and look at me, the artist. There's no attempt to have someone or to make yourself tear up or think, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
In art.
Yeah.
So that's the future of where we have to go.
It has to have that transmissive quality. Like if it breaks your heart open as you write it, then it's going to, and I stumbled onto this myself. I wrote a few posts where I got right to the end and I'm like, if I actually press post on this, it's going to be nuts. Cause I don't know if I'm slightly a psychopath, but my heart bled as I was writing this. And I knew that there was something there, right? It vibrates. It's like, holy shit. Like I stumbled onto something here. And kind of without fail, every time I'd press post, the right ones in a private message, cannot believe you just wrote that. I need to read that like 50 times.
It's right, Jordan. I promise you. That idea of creating art and creating a consciousness and a philosophy that is geared towards only that, what makes your heart stop, which is beauty. Which is what is the beauty in a passage or in a woman's face or in breaking bread with your brothers? That's what we're missing on earth. We're starving for it. That's why you get those comments. So the future of Ars Amarada, as far as I'm concerned, is the reclamation of that, you know? And it's, if there was going to be, like we had modernism, postmodernism, absurdism, existentialism, all these different isms, if there's going to be a new ism, then, you know, something like frissonism, which is the French word for exactly that feeling of just feeling that shudder, that peak experience, is Maslow's energetic feeling of that it's going to be okay. And that, you know, and you're connecting to something beyond yourself.
Yeah.
Frissonism is the future.
I've got a question on that, but before going there, I heard a very beautiful philosophical rambling about algorithms. And how you can be monitored. So you're asking the question, like, how can I actually compose the piece of music that makes Jordan's hair stand up on end and me come out in goosebumps? Well, you know, you look on YouTube or you look on Amazon and they know exactly what is your taste in music. And if you click on my mix, you've got 50 songs, 25 you've heard before, but the other 25 it recommends to you. So the deeper that algorithm penetrates into the body, it could actually measure the hormonal secretion that goes on. Right. and what is actually happening on a nervous system level, on a hormonal level in the body as I listen to music. And it could try and compose pieces of music which are absolutely apt to what floats my boat, depending on what mood I want to feel.
Yeah, so if it took 100 songs that you labeled personally as that really makes me think, you know, think about my life and whatever, and makes me pause and makes me tear up a bit, it can take those 100 songs and take elements from it. That would be interesting.
It can make up music on the fly with all the elements that touch that one particular person, because it's measuring it. Like, you know, that ring that you've got, you could actually wear a ring, and that ring would know when you're getting off to music or when you're actually a bit bored, right? There's vibrations and pulses it can pick up in your finger and compose some music on the fly for you that's going to make you feel a certain way based on all the music that you ever listened to before, which got measured by the system.
Okay, so, then here's my... Go ahead.
So we might end up in a situation where we're having a race for art or a race for transcendent, which is the man-made... Listen, I'm going to kind of download this straight from the divine and then put it into music, play it on piano. And then you've got the Amazon algorithm, which is, it's got all the information that it ever took from your body and your brain waves. And that's composing transcendence for you as well.
Except that, is that artificial? And by that, I mean, does it give you the emotional impact? Right? It gets hair stand up in the back of your neck. But does it give you the sense of destiny, legacy, feeling you're part of something, civilization? You know what I mean? Is there meaning in it? Because it's meaningless, really, if they just came up with this song that was created on the fly.
Yeah.
It doesn't have intent behind it, I guess you could say.
So one question is, how deeply can they decode and encode meaning? Like that algorithm can make it so granular, like it almost gets there. And then is there a human perception, if we switch it on, which goes beyond all of that, like that can tell? Because a lot of people will be fooled by it. You know, a lot of people are listening to Katy Perry all around the world, totally fooled by the fact that it's shit music.
So the difference is, I think the difference is, what AI may not be able to ever produce is meaning. It can give you emotional impact, but can AI ever give meaning, which means the sense that, you know, my ancestors came from, and I can feel that in my bone, you know what I mean? That's interesting.
Scary inquiry. The other thing I wanted to bring up, like, that's one rabbit hole. We've got about a billion we could go down. But this thing about transcendence, you're talking about frisson, is your word?
Yeah.
Frisson for the goosebumps feeling.
Yeah.
So going for that goosebumps feeling, is that a luxury of the postmodern man? Is there kind of like an upper class of semi-retired nomadic artist types who have automated income and just can look for transcendence? Because there are, right? You know, a lot of people traveling the world looking for those experiences, ayahuasca and all the rest of it, automatic. They've got their income and their lifestyle designed to a certain level that they can go around and search for transcendence. Is that going to be a luxury or is it a necessity?
Well, that's the thing. My presumption is that everybody, no matter the culture, no matter the religion background, whether atheist or not, they all have this longing for beauty, right? They all have the longing for that peak experience, of that transcendent feeling. They want to be loved and belong in a group, for instance, and be included in a group in every culture, in all of history. So so I don't know. Like, I think that anything you do going forward, anything you write going forward, any YouTube video you do going forward should have in mind, am I creating that for myself? Is that something that would make me have an impact on me? You know, because you don't know, maybe would it have impact on people in Nairobi, your videos, who are, you know, like scraping in the dirt and poor, maybe, for instance, right? Or I don't know. But there's something that's common denominator for all of humanity, which is this feeling of, I want to be warm, I want to be fed, I want, you know, those basic needs, and then I want to have companionship. I want to sit in fellowship, you know? I want to feel like I'm validated from peers, sort of thing. And then I want to live in where other people are. That's why there's towns and cities in every culture of the world. I don't care how poor they are. They live in groups because there's a real need, you know? So there's a common denominator underneath all of this. And we have the luxury of art and digital nomads because we've taken care of things that are basic necessities. We don't have to worry about where's our food going to come from.
Yeah.
You know? So we can be idle. We can go out. We can put graffiti all over buildings because we don't have to worry about, you know, going to hunt a deer. So we spray graffiti. We can do that. We can go out and protest with vagina hats on our head because of Western society has given us the ability to do that. You know? And the terrorists are out there saying, no, it's wrong, it's wrong. And they're blowing up. They're setting off their bombs with iPhones. You know what I mean? So they want the technology too.
Right.
Right? They're just as locked into the technology as we are.
Right.
So there's a common denominator of human need, which isn't food and stuff. It's what I think is like that longing for beauty, whatever culture you're in. Now, I can't say that Beethoven is the greatest. Like, you'll have the quote unquote Western world saying that Beethoven is one of the pinnacles of humanity, or Mozart, right? And you'll have people in your town in England say that, in my town in Canada say, yeah, it's like, you can't compare Katy Perry to that. But you look at other cultures, like in Romania, there's the villages in Romania and the kind of the gypsy energy there. They would listen to Beethoven and go, huh? They don't get it. They don't feel it. They don't doesn't give them a sense of frisson, you know? So, but they listen to that Manole music, which is little, and they listen to it day and night and they love it. And it makes them smile. So do they get this? So would they not say that that's the pinnacle of music, you know? So you can't just impose a culture on other cultures and say, this is the pinnacle and we're going to teach you. Like they did, you know, the Jesuits went out and said, this is the pinnacle of, you know, society, retrain you, teach you English because that's the best language.
Yeah.
But but below that level, there's a longing for beauty. So the beauty in Manole for that tribe or for those villages is no different than somebody crying up because they listened to a, you know, Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven. It's no different. There's that element underneath it, and that's beauty. So, I don't know. It's tough, man. Crazy, huh?
I wanted to ask you, your mentor, Sir Roger Scruton, passed away a couple of weeks ago. How's, and this is someone you sought out and visited a couple of times in England and wanted to do a bit of work with and introduce Amorati to, because he had a lot of well fleshed out thoughts on these topics. How's that landing with you, and is that affecting your thoughts and aspiration in your work?
It's changed something. Like, I was going to work with him, right? As you know, we had plans and we were going to, you know, put our energies together. Obviously, like, in the, you know, going to him as opposed to us together. You know what I mean? I wouldn't presume that I have any kind of a body of work or sense of experience and stuff that he does. So I was going to go with a group of people on pilgrimage to him.
Yeah.
And increase us all in that way. But the plans were in place, man. We had it all planned. We had a bunch of interest. We were working out the details of who's going to stay in what room. It was on that level. And he was excited, and then he died, and so that's just kind of, I was talking to his his personal assistant who works with him every single day on the morning that he died. I was talking to her, making plans about where the people are going to stay and, you know, how do we get the money transferred and this kind of stuff from the people. And a couple hours later, I found out he's dead. So the whole thing is kind of on hold. However, my immediate impact to it was, all right, we got to take over some way.
Yeah.
We got to take it over because there's nobody doing it. There's nobody having this kind of conversation, you know? And so we can't stop. We got to keep going. But now it's incumbent upon us to do it with our limited knowledge and our limited ability, but at least we got to do it. You know, we don't have the depth of the thinking and certainly not the education of someone like Roger, and not the connections and not the respectability from countries. You know, the last thing that happened to him a week before he died was the Hungarian government, the president of Hungary, gave him the Hungarian Medal of Freedom for, you know, what he did in the Eastern Bloc during communism, right?
Yeah,
and he's been honored by Czech Republic and all this kind of stuff. So
we've never
done anything like that.
Yeah, I want to insert this, like, for anyone watching. I read stories about how Sir Roger would penetrate communist borders with books, and where they were burning books from academics, he would actually bring a load of trucks and wheelbarrows of books from academics of the West back in, so they could have an internal cultural renaissance, like within behind the Iron Curtain. This is in the
and he smuggled 80s. Cash in. He smuggled cash,
right,
into Poland and a place like that. And he was roughed up by the secret police a few times. So he put his, you know, his money where his mouth is, sort of thing. And we've never done anything like that, you or me. We've sat at Bali and complained, you know, about little random things, you know.
Well, we've tried to smuggle ourselves into certain countries with no cash.
Yeah.
I don't know if that compares.
So, but we've got to take over somehow. I honestly think so. So this whole idea of what we've been doing in the past, which is the basis of what we've been doing, but it's got to shift into something else. Yeah.
So like, breaking this down a little bit, I know we don't have concrete answers at this point, but Ars Amorata it was never solely about women and attraction and dating and seduction, even though most people came to us because of those topics.
Yeah.
I think everyone really recognized that there was always something more that this was aspiring to and pointing to, right?
That's right.
In Ars Amorata 1.0, let's say, it was, and it has been, and it is primarily a training. Like, this is how you can maximize the beauty in your relationship to women. And this is how you can maximize the beauty you're experiencing in your life as an individual man. And yeah, I think
kind of like Jordan Peterson thing, which is get yourself in order, make your room, you know, get yourself ready to go. It's kind of like that. That's the 1.0 of it.
And I think there was something very individualistic about it. Design your life, have an adventure that isn't her. Yeah. Yes, there's a graciousness and a generosity, because it's not just about filling your cup from the women that you meet or the people that you meet and the experiences that you have, but there's a generosity and a giving as well. But it feels like the Ars Amorata 2.0, which, just to put a challenge out there, a word out there maybe to grow into, but there's something much more about what is needed for us as communities, societies, countries, an online and real life tribe of people that don't really find their philosophy fitting into any of the other big tribes, which are loud and all at war with each other at the moment. There's something new that's brewing, which women, of course, have to be a massive part of that, but it's this substrata of beauty, which you talk about. There is something, the fire, the torch passed on from Roger Scruton, onto you, onto your tribe, onto us. There's something being called forth.
And the key is, if we try and go, if we say, okay, let's go and fix society or give some medicine to society, who are we? You know, all we can do in other words, that intent to go out there and make some kind of cultural creative change I might be sincere, but I think it's misguided. I think all we can do is create a body of work by the time we're dead that would make us pause and make us cry personally for myself. And that will have the greatest impact we can do out there, you know, instead of trying to be earnestly trying to, okay, I want Jordan, I really want you to get this message. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've created this so you understand in your language, you understand it. You create something that you understand personally. The Jordans of the world will say, that's it.
Yeah. And there'll be people within our ranks that are like, yeah, let's turn around and do this. We've got an agenda and we must restore beauty. Yeah. You know, another faction of the social justice warrior, the right. Beauty justice warrior that turns back into society, fights it out in the culture wars, proves to everyone how we're right without listening to anyone else's perspective on it, which is just what everybody else is doing. But you're talking about a quietly turning away, not in complete defeat or rejection of what's going on, but
not at all.
Let's walk a path, a personal, embodied, soul focused path where, you know, if we can break ourselves open and cry on our deathbed because we were fully given with our gifts in life, then that's got to. That's our best chance of resonating this culture. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, because we can't produce works that are going to resonate with a lot of people. Manufacture the marketing.
That's trying to guess what's going to have an impact, and you can't do that because you can just create stuff, create an energy, and you know, and it's a solitary thing. You know, like it's, but it's also in collaboration. It's in, you know, the greatest things Steinbeck wrote in East of Eden, he said, there's nothing ever been be created by a multitude ever that has any value created by a multitude. It's a solitary mind that, and then the solitary mind goes to collaboration with another solitary mind. And then, you know, and then it expands from there. And there's some truth to that. So I really do think that if we go out there and try and, man, we're going to do this incredible change work, you know, it's the intention is there, but it becomes this earnestness, which is not good. And I don't know why I think that, but feels like we have to do something that's going to change us on an individual level personally. Like, what sermon would you want to hear is what you need to start to preach. What's something that you want to hear for yourself? Yeah. That's the only thing you know. You can't go to these people in the villages of small Romania and say, you know, Beethoven is way better than your music. That's what's been, you know, that's colonialism and imperialism has done for, you know, for centuries. They may be right. I don't know. But that, it's that sledgehammer try, you know, I'm going to show you the correct, you know, you're a small villager, you're primitive, and I'll show you culture.
Yeah.
So we can't impose culture. We've got to only create culture that has something to us personally. That makes sense to me. So when I'm dead, I can say, man, I listened to that music that I wrote myself, or I read that piece I wrote myself. That was for me. And that will change everything. That I think that'd be a huge impact, Jordan, is my thinking.
So this is the question of legacy that we're talking about, the topic of legacy. And it's like an artist's path or a seeker's path.
Yeah.
To find out what that is.
You better believe it's real, and you better believe it's about to happen. I don't know what it looks like for sure. I'm trying to write this book. That's why I'm here in Florence. I'm trying to write this book. And I spend a lot of time just staring at the wall and thinking a lot. And I pick away at the words and stuff. Yeah. And the stuff I've written, I like. At the same time, I'm like, can I say it? Can I say it? I don't know. Don't know.
Are we on the topics of your book on this conversation? Is this the kind of stuff that the reader can expect?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to write about. This type of thing, you know, without giving answers, of course. I'm trying to write about this. Yeah. What is that meaning of, basically I'm trying to write about the transcendent, you know, what is the call to something beyond, which is the call to art, you know, when you look at it, I was just in the Uffizi Gallery here. I took one day off and I went to the Uffizi Gallery where Botticelli's, you know, Birth of Venus and all these different things.
Wow.
Da Vinci and Michelangelo and Caravaggio and stuff. And I went and there's nobody there because it's winter here.
Mm.
So I was like standing with Botticelli's, in the room with Botticelli's Birth of Venus, which is one of the most famous paintings in the world. And I'm by myself.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Standing there and have the room to yourself sort of thing. And it's like, so I mean, like,
did you get a frisson?
Yeah, you do, you know, and so I mean, you know, Maslow talked about the hierarchy of needs, right, in 1960 or whatever it was, 1965. Yeah. But what people don't know is that he talked about, you know, here's your basic needs, which is food and water and shelter and warmth. Next needs is companionship and you know, validation and inclusion, and then the next need is level is fulfillment or, you know,
esteem, belonging.
Yeah. Right. And then the last very one is self-actualization, which we would call, you know, self-help and become more excellent and, you know,
become, all yeah, fulfill your potential, become all you can be. Yeah.
Yeah. The maximum you can be. But what people don't realize that not only did he create that thing, but he said the entire goal of life is to maximize those peak experiences. The goal of life is to create as many peak experiences as you can. In other words, make it a conscious thing that you're trying to do.
He slapped on an extra layer at the top of that pyramid in the last few years before his death. The business schools.
Oh, I heard it.
Yeah, the business schools where they teach the hierarchy of needs. They don't have this. It stops at self-actualization. So basically, so if you follow up to the top of self-actualization, all you are is a very actualized, competent individual kind of ego. The typical CEO boss who's successful in the things that he's striven for throughout his entire life. But then there's a glass ceiling. Because if there's no peak experience, or if there's no window that goes into the self-transcendence, which is the final peak that you put on his pyramid, there's a dryness to that. It's like that typical thing of, and you've worked with tons of men like this in your Kazen Maratha experience.
Is that all?
I have everything, but my hairs on my body are not tingling. You know, my goosebumps are not tingling. I'm not dating that girl and then running home at the end of it, clicking my feet together three times because it was so beautiful. It took me beyond the scope of my best potential.
So that's where it's got to go. That's the level we're talking about, Jordan. And that's all I think about. And how to tap into it and what does that look like if we were to write about it or make music about it or, you know, that's all I think.
2.0 and the new book coming soon. Sure.
Just beating me up, but I'm working on it.
This was a random catch up with the two of us, right? We're about to record some other videos and we got waylaid, but if you like the philosophy of this, I'd love to hear your comments below because we'll stick this out somewhere, YouTube, Facebook, all the rest of it.
We should make this the video series because this is what this we one? Wanted. This is the kind of the people we want in Essentials that are having this, I mean, we sat here a lot of questions and not a lot of answers, but it's what we want to go to. Right?
Yeah.
This is the kind of guys I want. You know, we talk about our Amirati ritual in our list. One of the things I have in my list that I want to manifest for myself is I want to sit in the company of philosophers. That's what I want. You know? How? I don't know. But I want to sit in the energy of people who are having the same conversation, interested in this conversation. And so this is the kind of people we want to draw into our, into the Amirati. And that's the conversation I want to have on the Amirati is, you know, we had a lot of low level questions in our Amirati Facebook group about masturbation. So that's not a conversation, you know. Might be a valid conversation and guys have legitimate questions, but it's not something on what we're trying to understand, I don't think. So anyway, so one idea.
One topic that for me, I know you have a lot of resistance against the notion of self-help and the personal development industry. Not all of it.
Yeah.
You know, don't want to tar it all with the same brush by any stretch of the imagination. And there's a lot of stuff in there that's useful for a lot of different moments and needs. But there's something about the compulsion of self-help and that personal development cycle that a lot of us find themselves in, a lot of our members find themselves in as they find our message, that I know that is antithetical to what you believe.
Yeah, and I don't know why, but it just, there's something in it. It just, I don't know what it is. It's new, right? It's new. Like, I mean, if you look at Virginia Woolf and some of these writers in the 20s and 30s, they were reading books on how to be a better writer and how to be better excellent. So self-help's like 120 years old or, you know, over 100 years old. But it feels like it's the number one genre of book out there right now is self-help, which blows my mind. The next thing is memoir. Right. Which is Jordan writes his life story at 38 years old or whatever age you are, writes his life story and the things he's learned and stuff like that. And everybody's doing it. They're teaching that in literature classes. Their assignment is to write your memoir. You're 23 years old. Write your memoir.
Wow.
Which is all about me, which is
complete
Instagram.
Complete narcissism. So the first one is how can I be better? And get the things I want more and more in life. And the second one is, how can I tell my story more effectively to position myself and all the rest of it?
So two things that I naturally have a revulsion for, which is self-help and memoir. It just blows my mind because it's all about me. And it blows my mind. And that's all there is. That's the number one and number two genre of books that are being sold. You go into any bookstore and it's self-help. Business help, for instance, right? Or any of this kind of stuff. And or the memoir of me and, you know, what happened with me and my father was a drunk and my mother beat me up, you know, which happened to all of us. And yet it's become this thing, you know, it's like weird.
And that's the state of our culture.
That's the state of our culture. Look at me, 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 you know? Even like I said, like art has shifted into the artist, you know, the Tate Museum in London shows Tracy Emin's bed, which is her unmade bed. My bed's right there and it's not made. And she took her entire bed with the vodka bottles beside it, used condoms and stuck it in the museum. The museum bought her for a couple million pounds, her bed, you know, and it's what is goes for art nowadays because it's about the artist. This is me. And the other thing she did was all the men I've slept with, and she put the names of all the men she slept with in this kind of a tent thing and just their names. And that was sold for, you know, that it's about all about her. The artist has become the supreme thing as opposed to what she's trying to create. And she's not alone. And so the whole, this, and Instagram, everything has shifted into look at me. And everybody's a blogger. Everybody's writing on medium.com, you know?
Yeah.
There's so much out there. Everybody can now, and I'm not saying there's it's a lot of bad stuff. Well, there is a lot of bad stuff. But the whole point is this entire culture of us in our Western society can be summed up as look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. My rights. I look at my, what about my rights as opposed to my duty to my community? My
identity politics. Yeah.
Identity politics. It's all about the individual and me. And I'm thinking, you know, so
on that end of the spectrum, I'm just cutting quick, on that end of the spectrum, you got the identity politics. I was, you know, I'm from a group of victims, so I'm going to stand up and, you know, claim my peace here and get just vengeance for the anger that I feel because of my group and my persuasion and my beliefs and so on. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got lifestyle porn, like this influencer industry. Look at me, look at me, look at me. I'm fucking pornographic, which is what Instagram is, right? Like my self-image is better than the other self-images out there. So follow it, basically.
After I've taken 200 photos and taken one of those and then doctored it for 4 hours.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I still feel like I didn't get enough likes on it.
And the problem with that is all this focus on me, 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 the classic art, like the, what you were talking about, going to see Botticelli and these moments where you can really get an frisson or impact or something shifts your consciousness. Like in my kind of, I did a retreat last year, which was about meditation and art, basically. And we studied the that Botticelli painting you were talking about. It's laden with mystical references and occult symbols and so on. And if you look at it the right way, the idea is that it changes your consciousness. You go into the painting, and if you spend a good 5-10 minutes with it, it will do subtle things to you. And that was the intent of the artist. Can you perceive that as a viewer? Well, that's down to a training or a perception.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of training to understand fine art as well as create it, right? So it's a language that you can grow into and learn. But I think these works that stand the test of time are, rather than look at me, 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 it's look at us, 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 or look at that, that, that.
Exactly.
Look at that.
Botticelli was not about himself. He wanted to be famous and he wanted to bang all the girls in Florence and, you know, like, of course, right?
Yeah.
So he was trying to be like better than all the other guys on his personal level, but his art was about, look, his representation, you know, and they can, or lack of a better word, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's the symbolism I can put into here?
And the same in dating, not look at me, 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 but look at you, 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 not your self-image, but who you really are, what motivates you, who are you really? And look at that, 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 which we can experience together.
Yeah, like, you know, like, here's the girl, here's you, the relationship is here. It's the third thing. I wrote about that in the Alabaster Girl, you know? And it's like, and even in the conversation, you're looking out here to the horizon, what's possible. That's creating a vista, you know? Hmm. And it's what we're missing. It's all about me, 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 me. Incredible.
Someone asked a little while ago in the Azamarata group, what is new self-help book that's really useful?
Yeah.
And my instant reaction was read literature.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And I think what's pernicious about the self-help cycle that we get on is that as we're busy helping ourselves, we're stuck in a cycle looking at ourselves. We don't actually learn correct. How to see. We don't that's learn how correct. To see at all because we're trying to perfect that mechanism or get that image that we can display to the world. And the gift in all of this is to be able to see it.
No, that's correct, Jordan. Absolutely correct.
So yeah, there's nothing, if you read, what's that great book? The Unbearable Lightness of Being, you will learn more about relationship psychology in those 300 odd pages than you will in 20 relationship psychology because it's visceral. And you can see that the complexes and how these men and women are like slightly fucked up, but they're staying in relationship with each other and they have all these dynamics and one goes to the war-torn country, one sneaks across the border. And it's just like these motifs. I've heard Sir Roger Scruton talk about this as well. There's motifs about our relationship life. There was something in the background on the day we met, which resurfaced 2 years later when we had the argument on the hill. And then 5 years later, we meet again in the original city and the same motif that was running all the way through, it comes back. It's like a classical piece of music.
Right.
And there's something about, I mean, I remember listening to your stories of the early women that you met when you were a teenager or in your early 20s that you would meet some kind of hippie or mystic traveling girl who would reading Hermann Hesse and all these people, that would just turn your mind upside down with their view on life. That, and I think most of us have an experience of a woman who's done this. We're kind of living in a certain box. You know, as we get older, hopefully the box that we live in is getting bigger and bigger. But then a woman comes in at some point and it's just like, you're seeing everything through a box. And what you're missing is all of this. And if we're lucky, we meet a woman who shows us life outside of the limitations of our thinking. And it's by seeing, by reading literature or training a literary or an artistic eye, I feel like I get to see life and relationship unfold through the lens of a cinematographer rather than through the lens of a CEO who wants to measure everything and make sure that his stock is rising every single year and the return on investment is coming in and, you know, I'm getting more sex or more likes or more dates because I'm applying these principles. It's much more of a, and I think the only way, I asked this question to you a little while ago, is it a luxury or is it necessity? I think the only way I've been able to stick on this path with women so much for so long is because I've seen it through an artistic lens. Because if I'm trying to get things right or hoping that everything works out my way, I'm going to be so frustrated and disappointed. But if I can literally, and we've got fun, beautiful, heartbreaking stories of having everything with a woman and then two nights later with somehow left town, gone to the wrong place, we find ourselves sleeping on the floor in snowy Montreal. It's like minus 15 degrees outside, no woman in sight. And it's like, why, how have we lost this and ended up in poverty and an emotional hole all of a sudden?
Incredible, huh?
Right? But to be able to see life and relationship through these eyes of a lover or eyes of an artist, it changes everything. And if you read in self-help, you're never going to learn how to see that.
No. You're absolutely 100% nailing it, Jordan. And I never thought about that, but you're right. You can't see it. It's that's navel gazing. That's looking at yourself in the self-help mirror. And there's no sense of communion. There's no sense of artistic energy. And our Zemrata 2.0 100% has to be about an artistic bent, you know, has to be. Because that's the way we learn. Like I said, you read literature, you read stories of pirates that went to sea, and then you learn something about the human condition, you know, human nature. So,
yeah. The human condition, I think, this is something that we don't talk about, which is clearly transmitted in the Alabaster Girl, because you've got all these pieces that really ring with a subtle sadness. Like you talk about the beauty song of women, and I know the amount of people that's brought tears to the eyes of, that women have a beauty song. No one has ever heard it, especially not themselves. Like very, very few women are actually conscious and understanding that they have a beauty song and they know what it is. Everyone reads that passage and it's like, it's true. You know, that's truth. Fuck. I had to put the book down and cry. Just contemplating that idea and feeling that the way that you wrote it. And that notion of humanity, we've talked all these years about seduction and romance, and the guys want to get their result. They want to get their outcome. You know, we all want the great relationship with the Alabaster Girl and so on. But the humanity part of it, I was talking with one of our guys from the Mastery Program and he asked me, beautiful conversation, beautiful man, quite quiet, lots of depth. You know, very, very deep. And he's working in a hospital. Mm-hmm. And he said, we're having a talk. And he's like, I think I'm on a good path. But Jordan, have you got any thoughts? Like any thoughts of guidance or any thoughts about how he can unfold? And I'm like, wow, you know, you're working in a hospital in the UK at this moment in time. In the UK, everyone is at war with each other on the subtle level, right? It's don't think it's breaking out into fist fights all over the place, but the repressed anger and everyone's hostile judgment at each other, the stiff upper lip is kind of crumbling and all the shit's coming out. And he's working in a hospital where you've got the staff who are underpaid and overstressed, and they're in their whole dynamic. And then you've got the patients who are trying to get better or not.
Yeah, exactly.
In this whole circus. And I'm like, you're a witness on the battlefield, the battlefield of humanity. And I said, listen, there's nothing you need to really do differently to what you're doing, because he's really got our principles in a really beautiful way. He's got them down. He said, yeah, I don't know why. I've been here for three weeks already, and there just seems more women with their hair down and wearing makeup as every day goes by. I told him there must be a really good looking new guy that just started in the office the same day as he did. Probably hasn't met him yet.
Why is women all wearing mini skirts all the time? Maybe they weren't.
Yeah, right. On my first day, I didn't see any of them. Now it's half the office, half the hospital. Yeah, and the only kind of coaching, quote unquote, that I could give him was just to slow down and be more and more present with the things that are actually happening. Like in every awkward meeting you have with a coworker, or every difficult moment you have with a patient, like slow down and taste it fully. Hmm. That thing, masculine edge, right? You've talked about for many, many years, masculine edge holds a vibration. Like a man who's been out in the world and seen some things, he vibrates on a certain frequency. And most women can feel that in a certain way. I'd like to tell the story of like the most experienced seducer in the world stood at a bar against the novice who's all in his head figuring out what he should say and how it all works. And they're both sipping on a beer. And there's no difference to tell between them in terms of their body language and the fact that they sat at the bar not trying to talk to any women. But the one who's, you know, been all around the world and slept with thousands of women, he has this inner tattoo, right? He resonates on a certain frequency, which is composed of everything he's seen in his life. And the other guy doesn't. He just is vibrating on his own insecurity and self-centered thinking. But I said to him, just slow down and taste every awkward moment in that hospital, because it's going to inform your vibration and you'll see some things. And it's humanity. It's humanity.
Yeah, right. The human condition, exactly.
To stay very present in the face of people and yourself being pushed right to the edge of what you can handle. That's beauty. That's the transformative thing.
Wow. Yeah, lots to think about, man. It's exciting times, you know, and I don't know. We're on the edge of something. I can feel it, and we can't articulate it. We talk in circles around things, but at least, and maybe we never will. But at least we're thinking about it. At least we're trying, right? At least trying to figure it out. You're sitting in Thailand. I'm sitting in Italy.
Yeah, it doesn't need, because I think anyone watching this who's thinking, shit, I always thought the Ars Amarata was abstract. This is getting even worse. We don't actually need answers to many of these questions. And
no, because by the time you're old, you look back and you say, well, you know, I think it was Thoreau said that, you know, when you're a young man, you gather this building material around you and you're going to build these temples and cathedrals. And you have this old plans and stuff. Yeah. And when you get to your late middle age, you look around and you said, well, I guess I'll just build a woodshed because with my materials I gathered, you know? So, and so you build a woodshed instead. And it's when you get to the end of your life, when I get to be 90 years old, 100 years old, I'm going to live to 100, by the way, everybody. Ever watching this, when I get to 100 years old, I'm going to be, I am certain that I'm going to look back and go, man, I don't know. I have no idea. I saw this video with this philosopher, he's 97. Mm. And he wrote a bunch of books when he was 40 and 50 and 60 on the human conditions of that. And he's old and he's sitting there and he's eating some eggs and stuff like that. And he said, you know, I spent my whole life trying to find answers and trying to find meaning. And I failed. That's exactly what he said. And I failed. And that was it. Incredible. You know? Like, hey. He was so certain in his writing, in his books, and he wrote all these books.
Yeah.
So certain. And then he says, I tried to find meaning and I wrote about it and I spent my whole life dedicated to it. He wasn't a bricklayer. He was a philosopher that wrote books about meaning of life and the meaning of death. And he gets to the end and he's sitting there and he's just like, I spent my whole life trying to figure out this sense of what meaning of life is. And I failed.
was there joy when he said it?
No.
Despair? Like,
just like not surprised, not upset, not frustrated, just like, yeah, I failed. I tried and I failed. You know? And I'm certain, you know, you look at, they say the last words of Michelangelo, one of the last things Michelangelo said, or Da Vinci, I can't remember, one of those two, who are like the pinnacle of achievement, what we think of, and genius. Was it? I think it was Da Vinci. And he said the last words of Da Vinci were, my biggest regret is before God and man, my work was crap. Hmm. I didn't do what I wanted before God, and I didn't do it before man. You know, my work is all crap. Incredible.
So we're going to create this with a lot of pomp and circumstance, this fantastic world-changing Arza Murata 2.0. And we're going to not take ourselves seriously in the process.
Yeah, because you're not going to get an answer. But, you know, how presumptuous do we think we can figure out things, you know? Like, what is the answer of, are we going to come up with an answer of, you know, why is the macro physics different than the quantum physics? What is the, that was Einstein spent the last 40 years of his life trying to come up with a grand unifying theory of everything, which is, you know, how to take quantum physics, the math of that, which is different than the math of the universe, and how to combine it. And there's got to be a way to combine it. Mm. Think about it. We just are, maybe our minds can't comprehend on that level. And we're presumptuous if we think we're going to come up with some kind of grand unifying theory of everything. But at least it's fun to think about it. And it's when we're old, we look back and say, man, we sure tried.
Yeah.
Which is more than most people ever say. So.
And within that trying, there were moments.
Yeah. Moments of little understandings and little aha moments. And the whole thing is like, and that's what I want to surround myself with people like that. That's why the people we want to come into Essentials and the Amorati and the Arza Murata, I want them to have that bent, that kind of inquiry.
Yeah.
Sit in that inquiry to the day they die. That's the person I want to have communion with.
The seeking.
Thing of coaching guys, you know, want to come do some coaching. I'm thinking, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to do that kind of coaching. I want to sit in the company of peers who are trying to sit in inquiry and trying to understand these interesting things about life.
The seeking peak experiences, the seeking frisson, the seeking being impacted by
exactly
the humanity, the extraordinary things in the world.
Freesonism.
Yeah. They're looking for encounters with beauty that they can't really explain or describe.
And that nobody's talking about, and they can't get it from their school, their work, their colleagues, their social circle.
And is absolutely un-Instagrammable.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah, it defies the lifestyle porn culture.
Yeah. Interesting, huh?
You know, with every year that goes by, my energy for this picks up in a way. Energy of feeling like I have a sense of purpose and I could say some good mission statements for what my purpose is, but, you know, none of that ever cuts the mustard. No. You know, purpose is a feeling. You wake up and it's running through your veins and you just want to do something, or it's less.
Inspire others to be all they can be in excellence.
Yeah. It's something that flows through your veins. And I think a friend of mine said to me, how do you know when you're, how do you know if you've had a good year in business? What are your metrics? You know, how much money, how many clients, all that kind of stuff. And I said, I think in a calendar year, if I have 10 moments where I spontaneously like cry because it was that exquisite what we did, that was a good year.
There you go.
So there's there's the beauty metric to it. But I think what I'm getting at here, the start of Essentials, which is the start of our training path and our conversation, because the Emirati really is an ongoing conversation, right? I think it's, first of all, it's an ongoing conversation with ourselves. You sitting on your bed, laying at the ceiling, wondering, walking around the streets at night, how the hell does all this stuff work together? It's an inner conversation. Like, what is a life of beauty in the way that it is beautiful and meaningful to me? It's a conversation with others that are on the same path, looking for answers. But how can I say, not even enjoying the questions. We're kind of stuck with the questions. Like our constitution is in a such a way that we're thinking along these lines and traveling along these lines and saying goodbye to parts of our lives that are uninspiring so we can have more of this unknown that we're trying to figure out. It's just our constitution.
Trying to erase stuff gets in the way of that kind of thought process and that, yeah.
Yeah, like renouncing everything that gets in the way of this seeking to find my essence, which is my art, which is the thing that I want to give, which has inherent value. This is an ongoing conversation. And the very first part of that training is, first of all, we talk about designing your life, right? Like, what is a beautiful life and what is something that you want to move towards and what is stuff to renounce?
That's the first thing that we talk about, yeah.
That's a massive conversation, because it's like, who do I need to become as a man? What does that mean to me?
Yeah.
If I am to live this life, who must I be? What must I embody to create that? So that's big. that's the first week of the course, but it goes a long time. The second step.
You're insane, Jordan.
do that in a week. The second step is, how do I stop myself from being that and creating that life? The saboteur. Like,
pausing and hesitating, yeah.
Yeah, like, what are all these voices and bits of conditioning and who are all these other people living inside my head pretending that they're me, trying to do other things and getting in the way of the life that is true for me? So there's a process of weeding all that out. Of course, we do that together as a group, bit by bit, challenging each other. You know, you're saying that, but that's your negative thought. It's not really true about who you are. Look at it in this way. We offer each other different perspectives, invite each other to see more deeply in different ways. The third theme, and I'm just going to go through four, not going to talk through the whole program. The third one is to look at our lineage and to feel that we've got a archetypal blood of champions. You talk about the blood of champions. I love all this work that's coming out at the moment. Jordan Peterson's kicking a lot of it off, but it's a rebirth of Jung and this archetypal psychology. And what I love about archetypes is it's not like, oh yeah, I really like that guy from that movie. And I really like the lover archetype and Don Juan and Casanova. So I'm going to stick pictures of them on my fridge and hope to be like them one day. These archetypes actually have things that we can grasp hold of and embody and become. And there's a lot of different things that we can do to do that.
Are old and cultural agnostic. In other words, those archetypes, for instance, you know, Jung and the people that, you know, were students of Jung, they went in, for instance, they examined all the myths of the world, Joseph Campbell and stuff, yeah. Examined the myths and the, you know, there's a Russian guy, I can't remember his name. He examined thousands of Russian fairy tales.
Mm.
And he took out the seven elements that they all compose, you know, they all had, which is archetypal. So yeah, absolutely. It's in our DNA.
And we can train it. You know, the warrior archetype is a very simple one to train. Write a to-do list and then smash off every item on that to-do list and do it every day consistently on time. You know, if you're doing that, you're embodying the warrior. The lover one is, can you stay very present in the moment? Like, what constitutes a lover, right? And I think the key of it is, I'm so present and enraptured in this moment, my attention is not going elsewhere. Because yeah. The lover is the one, like you say in your book, numinous and luminous, beauty is a... I can hang out in its current all day like a bird or something like that, right?
Wow, so, that's old, man. That's
yeah. Old. It's to be present in such a way that no moment of the experience is missed and everything is tasted through all five senses. So what every great lover has in common is that his attention is not split. He's not talking to the girl and then thinking about what's later on. Yeah. He's not talking to the girl and thinking, how's he going to get her into the bedroom? He's in that moment. Do you see, do you feel where we are right now? Look at this restaurant, look at this food, look at the surroundings. How good does that taste? You know, like right in the moment. So all the senses are activated. Anyway, so many practices and training to master all these parts of these archetypes.
That you're interacting with, like that girl has never been in the presence of someone like that ever, ever. That someone that's sitting there and tasting and smelling the, you know, and in the moment, in the present, you know, we talk about being present, and someone who's really maximizing, wants to maximize that experience with the girl, wants her to be included in it, wants him to have the best experience he can have that evening, and her to be included in it too. So that you're, like I said, you're heading towards, you're fighting for, and you're moving towards those peak experiences, that sense of frisson. You're looking for it in every moment. And maybe you don't acquire it. Maybe you don't obtain to that. You know, you don't get it. But you sure do your best to try, you know?
Yeah.
For her and for you. That's the kind of man that a woman will say, I've never met anyone like this in my life.
Yeah.
I've never seen before, man or woman, ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that can be simple. You might be able to take a woman to the Uffizio Gallery and show her the Botticelli and guide her through that in a way that gives her frisson. We did a tea ceremony.
Take her to the pub. Take her to the pub and around the corner. And
we had that, right? So out in our little village in Thailand, they have an artisan fair, and there's a Thai couple that cooks English baked goods, and they make Scotch eggs and sausage rolls. So we went there this morning. We met Matt Popkin and his girlfriend up there. They went to check out the sausage rolls. They make Scotch eggs. I'm not kidding. British Scotch egg, right? You get from the bakery for 50p. Nothing to write home about. They make Scotch eggs and sausage rolls with so much love and attention. It's better than anything I've ever eaten in the UK.
Wow.
And my girlfriend dragged me down there this morning. She's like, this is our last, she's laughing at me now. This is our last Sunday. We need to get a Scotch egg. Before there's no, and we sit with a Scotch egg and cut it in half, and it's like, fuck. And like, babe, I never tasted anything Russian. Like this. She's Russian, yeah, and she loves it. She and the people, and then the people that run the Scotch egg and the sausage roll stand, they're taking selfies with us at the end of it because they're like, these customers are so great. They adore everything we do. They're having like this transcendent moment through our cooking, so they adore us and they want to have the picture with us.
That's funny.
So yeah, I mean, those moments we have through just a cup of tea on the balcony. We made a little tea ceremony for fun and had a cup of tea and took it slow, goosebumps, the whole thing. To get that present in the moment, and these are lover skills. So what makes up the lover archetype, we can deconstruct and train. And we do that at length.
Yeah, that's great, man.
Because it's, if you can slow down in the moment that much, later will take care of itself. I mean, that's evident.
That's true.
That's evident.
Very good, man.
Yeah.
So and do then we have to do video?
Huh?
We have to do video still, or we use this?
No, this is it.
Oh, I didn't know. I would have pulled my hair.
No, this is it.
We're on a nation.
And then the fourth bit, I'm just going to go to four on the essentials course. The fourth theme is curiosity. For me, that this is what we've done on this, in this conversation, Zan, is curiosity, because the saving grace from a life of self-help and a life of self recurring thoughts. Am I good enough? Am I this? Am I that? You know, that's always going to go on. We're always going to have parts of us, ourselves that are broken, and parts of ourselves that are incomplete. The very nature of being a human with an ego is that it's incomplete perennially. The gift of curiosity, and we've just been speaking about what, like the future of art, the future of philosophy, the lost history of all kinds of stuff. What's going to happen with algorithms and bionic chips, the fall of the West and the rising of the nation states. Where else have we been? The hospital, literature.
Yeah.
The humanity of that girl, her beauty song and her motivation and who she is underneath it all and what she might wonder in a quiet moment that she never tells anyone about. As soon as a man becomes curious about all these diverse and sundry things, he's saved from his own internal self chatter.
That's right. Because ultimately, you know, whatever we think, I don't care if you're 19 years old or 90 years old, what's behind all of our thought processes is the concept of salvation. How do we be saved? And nobody in this modern world is talking about that concept at all. It's stripped out, you know. Religion talked about it, and philosophy talked about it, and the Greeks talked about it, but it's been stripped out of our modern society, the concept of salvation. How do we become saved? How do we feel that there's, yeah, exactly what you're saying. So
curiosity is salvation.
Exactly.
I'll stand up and say that. Because if you can actually externalize all your awareness, like put all your awareness on something else that isn't you, you're instantly saved. And that can be a woman, but it could be a Scotch egg.
Can't get a woman, but
and you don't have to go to Florence to get it.
That's hilarious. No, it's true. It's like, and that's where it has to go, that kind of concept and that kind of thinking. And I want to be around that kind of thinking for myself, for my own education and my own edification. I want to know, I want to explore these ideas. So, I mean, like you talk, you know, Proust talked about, he wrote an entire essay on the madeleine that he was eating. You know, he's eating this little madeleine, which is a little French type of pastry, cookie thing. And his whole life, his whole childhood came back to him. He wrote an entire thing about that. And he said, that's the measure of man. That's the measure. So you talking about the Scotch egg is as good as anybody talking about anything that's excellent in this world. Because your girl is saying, let's go have a Scotch egg, you and me, Jordan, you and me together in communion together, and do this before we leave this country, right? And it's like, what else is there?
Yeah.
You get to see her smiling face. You get to enjoy something that you knew as a child in England. In this foreign country, and you get to the collusion of all that together, the accretion of all those elements together, is the measure of life, you know?
Yeah.
Incredible, man.
And I know that any time that she's a little bit thinking about the past, she's going to be thinking of the Scotch egg and wishing she was back in Thailand having the Scotch egg. So these are the secret maybe things that women are thinking about when you're not around.
I was thinking yesterday, you know, I'm sitting in my hotel room here, and I'm thinking, and something popped up to me. I can't remember what it was. I was reading something. And if all of a sudden you had $1 million and I'm sitting in Florence, what would I do? Different than I'm doing now. Would I eat different food? Nope. Would I get a different hotel room? Nope. Would I get, you know, like what, like at some point you go, wait a minute, that money can't buy that experience. What I'm trying to say is what we're chasing, we're trying to chase that solution. We buy hope. That's what we're trying. That's what we spend our money on, hope. We're spending your money on hope, you know, so that I can get that moment with a girl with a Scotch egg.
Yeah.
We're trying to buy that with trying to get a better job, trying to get a, you know, accumulate better car, better things, you know, and or trying even self-help is trying to buy that too, trying to buy hope. We spend our money, we spend our energy and our time on hope. And because you cannot buy that with money, that moment that, of your girl saying, let's go have a Scotch egg, you and me together, you could be a billionaire. And it wouldn't make that experience, you couldn't do that experience differently. It's bizarre, man.
Yeah.
Nobody knows it, you know?
I mean, with all the men I speak to all the time, it's every 2-week vacation or every 1 year of backpacking is all saved up for, agonized for, journeyed for, paid for, in the hope that there will be one night with one girl that makes the whole thing worth it.
Yeah, exactly. Incredible. That was all my vacations in the past, you know, like when I was young.
Yeah.
I save up money, go to Mexico and like, and not sleep because you did not want to miss that moment. You would not sleep. There's no way you're going to sleep because you got to go on the beach and you're like, and then you got to go out that night. But you cannot stop, and you cannot stop because you don't want to miss that moment because you came away to try and experience something that you could never have. You know, you try to buy it. Incredible.
Yeah.
You got a good sunburn. That's it. Yeah. Well, there you go.
Well, I think with us in this talk, we'll see if Serene can magically chop these up into four useful parts and think of a good title for them. And then if you're watching, and this is for you, I'll say this with total conviction. We're talking about something very mysterious. We're talking about the ineffable, and we're approaching it, and we're living it, and we're shaping our lives around it, and tasting it quite often, quite often. This is the meaning and whole juice of life. Compared to this, dating coaching and some relationship coaching is quite easy. It's quite easy. And whatever your questions are with meeting women and dating and connecting, we'll solve all of those along the way. Like, they'll get solved during the conversation along the path. You'll have Zan's help, you'll have my help, you'll have the help of 400 plus brothers all keen to muck in and mastermind where you're at. But the real path is this. And if you resonate with everything or a lot of what we've been talking about and the way that we've been talking about it as well, this delightful, curious wondering about what's really going on and what does the future bring and what is an incredible, enrapturing way of life, then join the Amorati.
Mm.
Join it. Sign up for Essentials, 13-week program. We covered the first 4 weeks. There's more. You can check out the landing page if you want more info.
Starting in a couple of weeks, the next class.
Starting soon. Yeah, you'll be part of a group of like-minded men. And if you make it to the end, you'll be part of the Amorati proper. And this is our brotherhood, our society, our group of men that are, what are we doing? Turning around from the crazy fighting, warmongering that's going on between different tribes and eking out a much more memorable life. And we meet in person twice a year. It's an online community, but we meet in person twice a year in Romania. And we've got groups all around the world doing little meetings. And it's a real modern days gentleman's club. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. So, not everybody's, you know, called to this kind of conversation. And a lot of people might not say, well, it doesn't apply to me, but if if it does, then that's who I want to, that's, I want to hear that, that voice, you know, I want to hear that, I want to meet that guy. That's a cool guy.
Yeah.
That's somebody like, you know, that it's such a rare thing. It's so rare.
And it's someone to carry on this work. You know, as you say, Sir Roger passed away a couple of weeks ago. Torches come onto you. The torch is in our tribe. And it's, yeah, and it's not about us and it's not about you, but it's about the carrying forth of culture, yeah, and beauty that is important to your heart and that you want to see more of in the world as a gift to the other people that come into your life. Family, children, women, of course, and your friends.
Exactly.
In your workplace.
Incredible.
Yeah. So sign up. If this is for you, click the button and we'll be starting shortly.
Excellent.